The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering backup solutions that help protect digital data in home or at work, and offering data recovery services for damaged hard drives or lost files. More info at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. The map insists that the place exists. But following 4 years of civil war, can it even be said that there is a place called Syria anymore? The divided loyalties of Syrians have already rendered the government useless in protecting its own citizens, most of whom have up and left the country. This can be seen most vividly in the besieged city of Aleppo, caught in the middle of the onslaughts of airstrikes, most recently from Russia on one side, and extremist groups like ISIS on the other. Upwards of 70,000 Syrians in and around Aleppo are said to be on the move this week. As a result of the latest attacks, there remain 200 doctors in a city of once 2 million. For more, we turn to Zeydoun al-Zawabi, a prominent Syrian activist who has been detained by the Syrian government multiple times. He continues his work for the Syrian people as head of the Union of Syrian Medical Relief Organizations. He just arrived in Turkey after being in Aleppo this week. We spoke to him on Skype, and he says while people are afraid of the sky, they don't pay much attention to who's dropping the bombs.
I have seen planes. I belong to a humanitarian organization. It's none of my business to know what is this jet fighter. But what I know that civilians have to be protected. What I know that these jet fighters must not target civilians. What I know that hospitals have to be an immune places, a place that is not targeted. We have recorded so many health facilities targeted. It is a health facility in Syria right now, especially in opposition-controlled areas, is the riskiest place. Riskiest place, without exaggeration, is the hospital.
What did the doctors think of that?
Doctors are leaving. They have been in Syria, trying to stay there, sacrificing their lives. But for how long? For how long they can stay there? In all of Aleppo, we barely have 200 physicians. They have to serve like around 2 million people. They can't take it anymore.
Is Syria as we know it gone?
Maybe forever. It's too hard on me to see my country just being lost. But yes, maybe forever. Please stop this war. Please. Please. I beg you all, enough for us. We're tired.
Zeydoun.
I'm sorry, John.
No, don't.
I'm sorry, John. Don't
be sorry. You've helped people, families. You've helped people. You've ended this war for some people.
I tried, but this is not enough. You can't imagine when you see people just living just like this in the open. They don't know where to go. And you are talking about the poor of the poor who couldn't have a shelter or who couldn't have someone to take them outside the country. Sorry, but I haven't slept in 4 days. This way I'm a bit tired and a bit depressed. Extremely sorry, but...
Well, Zeydoun, I want you to get some rest. And I want you to think and remember as you fall asleep the people that you have helped and saved.
I'll try my best. Try my best. I will keep going. We don't have the luxury to rest. With every moment you rest, you feel someone is losing hope and life. You feel guilty if you get some rest. You feel guilty if you get some sleep.
You can rest.
You feel guilty if you just see your family. And you know many are not seeing their families. For God's sake, why? Why is this happening to us?
Zeydoun, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much. Thanks for taking interest in our country.
It's more than interest. And please get some sleep.
I'll try. Thank you.
Zeydoun al-Zawabi is a prominent Syrian activist who's been detained by the Syrian government but continues to work as head of the Union of Syrian Medical Relief Organizations. He's in Turkey now but may return to Aleppo in the next few weeks.
We are freezing. We are feel animals better than us because we are human. We have children, baby. There's all just a few days. They are freezing here. Nobody care. No government care. They are just laughing of us. Say no, we can't. We waiting orders. Which orders? We are human here, not animals.
That voice of a desperate woman who may have come from Aleppo or anywhere else in Syria is speaking to the BBC from the Croatia-Slovenia border. Cold, wet weather is normal for this time of year in Eastern Europe, but the massing of millions of Syrians and other migrating families in border areas of Slovenia and Croatia is not normal. Babar Balush is a UNHCR spokesman in Central Europe, and he spoke to me from Bratislava.
What we have seen is over 500,000 people arriving in Greece from Turkey through the Aegean Sea, where people take these risking journeys. And also, we are now seeing the return of the chaotic scenes at the borders in Central Europe and eastern part of the Europe. It is a worrying situation for us. These people, who majority of them come from Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq, they already have been through too much.
Where would you say the bottlenecks are right now? What are the difficulties getting people from the initial arrival countries farther into the places where they are applying for asylum?
The recent log jams at the border began when Hungary closed its border with Croatia. And that was the route people were coming from Greece into Macedonia, Serbia, Croatia, and Hungary, Austria onwards. So Serbia-Croatia border was a point where people were coming in large numbers. They were stuck. The situation has eased since yesterday. But still, even this morning, there were 2,000 people who were there. And the other concern was at Croatia-Slovenia border, because Slovenia at some stage said they cannot process more than 2,500 people. And what we're seeing in over the weekend, there were over 20,000 people in Greece. It is the same population that keeps moving on. So till the time we don't have a coherent collective reception and registration response from the European Union, more people are going to suffer.
What does it mean to process these families? I don't quite understand what the issue is here.
It's very difficult. I mean, it's an issue that has been made into a crisis by a non-collective action by the European Union. In terms of processing, what happens is, as soon as you land on a territory, you should be registered, screened, received, and your asylum claim should be judged. That can't happen in Greece because Greece doesn't have that capacity. So people move on trying to look for effective safety, and everyone so far has been helping on the population towards Austria or Germany. So what we want to see is a collective response where the 28 countries of the European Union come together to decide, because they recently decided on a relocation quota, on a relocation plan. That is going to fail unless and until they're going to start implementing it somewhere. And then we see the situation in Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq. I mean, the wars are just not going away.
If you're a family who arrives in Hungary and wants to get to Serbia and Austria and then into further into Europe, do you have to apply separately for asylum in each country, and that each country has to approve your ability to move on?
There are multiple layers of registration: Macedonia, Serbia, Croatia, then Slovenia, and onwards and onwards. And at some stages, you know, there are individual border measurements introduced, as we saw in the last 2 days, and that creates chaotic scenes and desperation. The level of desperation for these people increases because it's winter, it's raining. And I have seen families with young children as old as 10 days and 27 days. It has an impact on them.
Babar Balush is a UNHCR spokesman in Bratislava, Slovakia. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hey, migrants. Despite what you may have heard, Europe is actually ready to welcome you with open arms.
These asylum seekers and refugees can also play a very valuable role as workers, as taxpayers, very often also as innovators and entrepreneurs who can boost growth and help cope with an aging society.
That's former European Commission advisor Philip Legrain on this program last month, stating one of the realities within the European Union right now. But the problem perhaps isn't the people on the move from the Middle East, it's with the borders. Now, no serious leader of a nation state would seriously suggest the removal of national borders, but already, with instant global communications and large numbers of people already living in stateless territories, people are finding ways of working around borders, working around governments, working around national identities, making a longtime argument of Alex Tabarrok, professor of economics at George Mason University. We don't need borders, professor?
Well, borders are fine for controlling governments. I'm not against different places having different rules.
but they're bad for controlling people. I would like to see a much more open world, a world in which people are free to move about. You know, as you just heard, some people in the world, through no fault of their own, they're born in an economic desert, or they're born in a place where there's a war, there's a civil war going on, and we have imprisoned them there by building walls and barriers and people with machine guns and saying, you can't move.
So because of administrative procedures, we've created prisons out of conflict zones. And in fact, there's precedent for allowing people to move more freely.
Well, if you go back to the 19th century in the United States, for example, we had virtually completely open borders. Anyone from anywhere in the world could come to the United States and make a home here with almost no paperwork whatsoever.
And that was because the U.S. needed more people?
Because there was open land, and that was the feeling that there was plenty of room to grow. But in fact, there is still plenty of room to grow in the United States and in the developed world more generally. We've got lots and lots of room, and we could have a lot more people.
Is this another hit against the nation state? We've seen so many ways in which the nation state is threatened by, you know, multinational corporations. That was the first. Then you've got global communications. You've got the ability of people to transact commerce without crossing borders. And now this, do you think there's an argument for a fundamental rethinking of what the nation state is all about?
I do. So, you know, it's quite amazing when you look around the world today, ideas, they flow freely all throughout the world. Capital, money flows freely throughout the entire world. The only thing which doesn't flow freely is labor. And yet the right to vote with one's feet, the right to migrate, the right to move. This is one of the most fundamental human rights. And yet in our world today, we've divided it, we've separated it, we've created a system really of global apartheid, of dividing our world.
What would be the economic advantage of having a system like this?
Well, economists have calculated that if we had completely open borders, world GDP would double. So that's a doubling of economic output, not just in 1 year, but in every year going forward. Even if we just allowed in the developed world our labor force to increase by, say, 1%, that alone would be worth more than all of the world's foreign aid combined.
The political will to make it happen?
We're not there yet, but I think once people understand that this is a moral issue, that I think they will begin to change their minds. You know, we feel now today that it's wrong to discriminate against someone on the basis of their race or their gender or their sexual preference. And yet we discriminate against people based upon where they're born. We say, no, you can't come here. You're not one of us. You're one of them. So I think when people realize there's a moral issue, they'll change their feelings about borders.
Alex Tabarrok is professor of economics at George Mason University. Thanks so much, Alex.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA Cref, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org.
The medium screen, TV screen that once threatened the silver screen, the movie screen, is selling its broadcast signals to the companies that want to stream things to your tiny screens, the ones on your smartphones. The Federal Communications Commission announced late last week that TV stations have until December 18th to decide whether they're going to auction off their wireless spectrum. If they do, the FCC will then sell that spectrum to other companies, mostly phone carriers, who want better wireless coverage for their growing customer base, who are increasingly doing more and more on their phones, everything from reading the news to, as I said, streaming television programs. Joining us is Stuart Benjamin, former scholar in residence at the Federal Communications Commission and professor at Duke University School of Law. Stuart Benjamin, welcome.
Good to be here.
You know, it's kind of like musical screens. It goes from one screen to another screen to another screen, but it's the same programs probably, right?
That's correct. And what's fascinating here is this is something that people have been expecting for a long time. Nicholas Negroponte pointed this out 20 years ago, that not many people use broadcast television in their car. And so the big advantage of spectrum is mobility, but we don't really need mobility for broadcast, whereas people do like to carry their phones around with them.
And how will this additional spectrum help the phone companies?
Well, right now, the big problem for the phone companies is getting enough capacity so that people can do all the things they want to do on their smartphones, stream, you know, download, be able to send all sorts of fancy messages to friends and others. And I'm sure many of your listeners know it can be a very frustrating experience just not being able to get the connectivity you want. The big remaining tranche of spectrum that's not in government hands is broadcast spectrum. We know the value that consumers put on that spectrum for broadcast purposes, and we know the value that consumers put on it for wireless purposes, and it's much higher in the wireless context.
And if Channel 10 sells the VHF, I guess, frequency spectrum that constitutes Channel 10, will that mean there will be no more Channel 10?
So what's going to happen is part of the reason why only the government can do this, why this is actually one of those things that the government is the most efficient at. A lot of stations are going to give up their spectrum. A lot of stations are going to agree to share channels with other channels. And then the FCC is going to do what only the government can do, which is called repacking. So what is now Channel 44 may decide to share or go off the air. If it stays on the air, it might be moved from 44 to 10, in your example, or to 22, such that channel 44 is then freed up, and the FCC will also free up channels 42, 43, 45. The reason this matters is this will avoid interference then. And so the key here is that there's going to be a new, more compact broadcast spectrum and a ton of contiguous megahertz available for new wireless uses.
Speaking with Stuart Benjamin, former scholar in residence at the Federal Communications Commission and professor at Duke University School of Law. This is The Takeaway. Stuart, if this all happens and this repackaging takes place, is my television able to find old Channel 10, or do I have to get thousands of decoder rings to figure out where my local stations are, or will I even have them?
It's a great question. Almost assuredly, you will have local stations, and because your television is in fact now a fancy computer with a screen, it won't have any real difficulty making this adjustment. And so you should be largely unaware of it. And of course, if you're one of the 90% of Americans who doesn't get channels over the air anyway, you'll be entirely unaware of it.
Well, I only get channels over the air because I ditched everything. And I just do wireless data streaming, and I have one of these digital antennas that is connected to my television set, which gets spectacular pictures of all the local stations. After December 18th, is that going to start to go away?
No. As I say, your antenna will still pick up all the old stations. You'll know them by their call letters. Nothing will significantly change for you. The big change, frankly, that you'll notice New York has 23 full-power broadcast TV stations. I dare say that there is probably no New Yorker who has watched all 23 of those stations. And very probably all 23 of those will not remain, but the top six or eight will in all the big markets.
And suddenly this spectrum becomes extremely valuable for wireless companies. Is there a resale value to it? Will we see consolidation and changes in the spectrum within the wireless space, or is this the end of it?
What's fascinating here is right now we have two major wireless companies, AT&T and Verizon, that have the best spectrum below 1 gigahertz, which has some great propagation characteristics. That's a fancy way of saying this lower band spectrum goes through buildings very well, goes into canyons very well, and so has great coverage. And one of the hopes of this is that there will be now better, not only will there be more spectrum, but the FCC is trying to design the auction so that there might also be other companies that have access to this valuable spectrum. Back to your question about, you know, sort of the money flows. From the broadcaster's standpoint, it's a win because they aren't being required to sell. They are putting in the price at which they are willing to sell. And if that price isn't hit, then they don't sell. Nothing changes for them. This is an opportunity for them to cash out. The key is that if a broadcaster agrees to cash out, let me just pick a number, at, say, $300 million for their 6 megahertz, which is a ton of money, But a wireless company is willing to spend $1 billion on those same 6 megahertz. The government gets the $700 million in between that gets used to pay down the debt.
$1 billion. How disruptive is this, and are you happy about it?
I think this is hugely important because it will get a ton of additional, very valuable spectrum. I think it will significantly change the user experience for wireless users. And I'm tremendously happy about it. This is something I worked on when I was at the FCC. It's a rare situation where you get something where broadcasters win because they don't have to do anything, but they get this opportunity to sell, and we free up spectrum for what, again, we know is a higher valued use. By the way, how do we know it? Because it turns out we know what people are willing to spend for their wireless services, and we know how many viewers some of these broadcasters have. You know, the 23rd broadcaster in New York or the 26th broadcaster in L.A. And we know, frankly, how much money those stations make. They're going to come out like bandits if they sell, and consumers will be better off because the spectrum will be put to a higher valued use.
Stuart Benjamin, former scholar in residence at the Federal Communications Commission and a professor at the Duke University School of Law. Stuart, thanks so much.
Thank you.
When I was a little kid, the cable guy came to the house one day with his uniform on and installed this thing called cable for the very first time. And wow, we could throw away the rabbit ears and the strange rooftop antennas. Suddenly, they were not needed. The UHF thing in the garbage. Then years later, when my cable bill was pushing some ungodly number like $300 a month, I went back to the TV place and asked for an antenna. And she goes, a digital one or an analog? I said. Digital, I think. And so I go home and I connect this flat thing to my TV. And wow, a great free picture of my local channels and no more cable. I could get what I want from downloading. I took all my cable boxes back to the store, got a refund, simple as that. I'm back on the antenna. Is this landscape changing again, though? Richard Snyder is founder and president of Antennas Direct, an antenna manufacturer that has seen a 50% increase in sales over the past year. Richard, is your world, I mean, your world has changed so much in the last even 3 decades. Is it about to change again?
Oh, yes. Antennas are back again. And people are, you know, the conventional wisdom is that we're all supposed to be watching television on our iPads or our phones. And in reality, people are in America are going back to over the air in record numbers.
And does that mean that the broadcasters are going to chase them, or are these just the low end of the audience spectrum? And really what you're going to have there are, like, you know, Indian soap operas and people doing, you know, kung fu movies with subtitles, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I know the perception of an antenna customer is the elderly or the indigent, but it's actually the you know, the 20-something-year-old tech oriented person. A lot of them we call cord nevers. They are affluent, and they're watching actually premium programming over the air. And what most people don't realize is how much now is available over the air. And a lot of major markets, Los Angeles, for example, you can get 130 channels for free over the air. So we were just in Denver and we picked up 69 channels, and a lot of it is quite a high quality content. So we like the over the air digital is now the new basic cable, and people are buying an antenna and pairing it with a streaming service. And it, you know, it's giving people an opportunity to kind of liberate themselves from an unhappy relationship they may have been having with the cable provider.
Well, that's certainly our experience, and I'm not trying to sell your products, but what was that term you used? For the young hipsters who come in? Cord nevers?
Yeah, the cord, you know, cord cutting is getting a lot of attention right now as people are canceling cable, you know, rightly so. But a lot of young people, especially in the, you know, under the age of 30, have never had a landline telephone line, and they've never had a cable subscription. What they're doing is they're buying an antenna, hopefully from us, and they're getting a streaming service. And that's essentially their method of video delivery now.
Do you have rooftop antennas still, like you'd see in the old TV programs that showed all of America with aluminum antennas on the top?
Well, our antennas are now about a tenth of the size of what they would have been in your grandparents' day. So there have been a lot of advancements in over-the-air antenna design, and we can make antennas much more powerful, much more reliable, and much smaller than they would have been, you know, in the I Love Lucy days. zone. If you go to your retailer, you'll see the antenna categories at retail expanding, but the antennas themselves are getting smaller.
Your hottest selling item before we go?
Our best selling item is a model called a Clearstream 2, and it measures about 10 inches by 20 inches. And I think the sales, our sales volume is a refutation of the FCC policy that over the years is in decline. We're selling about 3,000 antennas a day, and the perception that over the year in decline is absolutely false.
Wow, 3,000 a day. Richard Snyder is founder and president of Antennas Direct, an antenna manufacturer that has seen a 50% increase in sales just in the past year. He spoke with us from Rapid City, Colorado. I'm afraid, quite frankly, this is a pretty disturbing story to learn happening right in our own country here in the United States. For 70 years, Sears Roebuck and Company's headquarters were in Homan Square on Chicago's West Side. All the game shows would mention it when they'd talk about prizes. Chicago 60609. Sears tested products, printed its catalog, and shipped goods all across the U.S. from Homan Square until the retailer moved into the Sears Tower in 1974. The Chicago Police Department took over part of the former retail complex and now operates an evidence and recovered property office that is also, according to the Guardian newspaper, a CIA-style gitmo on Lake Michigan, a black site where the Chicago PD conducts off-the-books interrogations, where suspects are restrained, denied access to counsel, and sometimes beaten. More than 7,000 people have been brought through the complex after they were detained, but before they were officially processed. Just 68 of those 7,000 inmates had access to their lawyers, The Guardian reports, citing police records obtained as part of a lawsuit the paper filed against the Chicago PD. Joining me now is David Gager, an attorney whose client was taken to Homan Square in 2011 after being arrested for marijuana. David, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What does it look like to be taken to Homan Square, and how much of a rep does it have on the streets?
Well, it's a disturbing experience for people who are in Chicago police custody. This is not the same as going through the front doors of a normal police station with a desk and a officer and phones. This is a red brick warehouse in the middle of two of the worst neighborhoods in Chicago, with no front door, no parking lot, surrounded by cameras, razor wire, floodlights, and you're let in there from one door or another, without any type of formal processing. And it's really a scary, scary thing for those people who are in custody and are being interrogated by the Chicago police.
How far did you get into that building?
On the occasion that I had with a client of mine who was taken into custody, I actually brought my client to that location where detectives requested that he be brought. So I got him to a door, since there is no front door, and was greeted there by detectives on the outside, where I told anyone who would listen that he was exercising his right to remain silent, and then he was taken and back into custody. So I actually never really breached the facility because I was not entitled to do so.
What did your client tell you he saw inside there?
Well, a lot of that information is somewhat privileged based on my interactions with him, but what I can tell you is that what goes on in there is not what you would expect in a police station, either in Chicago or, I'd have to say, in the entire country. This is not a place with rooms and processing, fingerprints, phones, analytics, nothing like that. This is totally different. It's a totally different experience, and it's not one that's on the books.
And legally speaking, I mean, when the police arrest you, there has to be a record of that arrest. You have to be charged with something within a particular period of time. Have the Chicago police created a zone where somehow habeas corpus doesn't apply?
I wouldn't necessarily say, or I wouldn't know to say that it's a zone. What I do know is that individuals are taken there and the process is different from all the other police stations that I've ever interacted with. I've turned clients in or visited clients at police stations all around the city, and the booking procedure is pretty streamlined. In fact, in most police stations, right on the wall when you get there, there is a sign that says rights upon arrest and all the things that someone in custody has the right to do, including speaking with an attorney and within a reasonable time contacting family. That's not what happens at Homan. And eventually those people are processed, but in many circumstances, we're talking hours and hours after they've been detained.
So what would the police be able to do at Homan that they couldn't do at a regular precinct? And what has your client told you, insofar as you can share it with us, that happened at Homan?
Well, the most important thing for anyone who has been detained by any type of law enforcement is to assert your right to remain silent and to speak with an attorney before any police officers, or even more importantly and more egregiously, any state's attorneys who prosecute cases, speak with you. And the issue that has come up at home and the issue that the Guardian had analyzed was that people were being either denied access to those attorneys, or attorneys couldn't find their clients and know that they were at home and until people had already spoke with them. And being denied that constitutional protection is a major problem, and it can lead to clients making statements both against their interests and potentially ones that are either not true or limited in the amount of full detail that they give.
But isn't it the case that in court, if Mr. Gager, a prosecutor, says, this is what your client said in custody, and you can determine that it was at Homan Square, it'll be thrown out because he wasn't read Miranda rights, he wasn't given basic access to counsel, that sort of thing?
Well, that's not necessarily the case, and here's why. In order for a statement to be deemed inadmissible because of a failure to be read Miranda or because it was given without the rights of an attorney, that has to be asserted through evidence. And an individual also has the right to speak with police should they want to without an attorney present. The issue we have here is at Homan, with no one inside, no cameras, no formal booking procedures, nothing like that, it is easily maintained by police. Well, your client made a statement. He said he wanted to talk with us voluntarily. He said he wanted to speak with state's attorneys and wanted to waive his right to counsel. Oftentimes, police testify that that was done orally, no signed written refusals, anything like that. And before you can do anything, as one of my football coaches famously said, you can't put toothpaste back in the tube. Things are already done, and your client's rights have already been waived. Or police are saying your client's rights have been waived and the statement is already in the report.
More than 80% of the people detained at Homan, black, 11%, nearly 12% Hispanic, way beyond the proportion in the population. What do the authorities say about Homan?
Well, here spokespersons for the Chicago police maintain that it was business as usual as far as the Chicago Police Department is concerned regarding arrests at Homan Square. And regardless of the demographics of who's arrested there, the procedure is not business as usual. It is anything but business as usual. And the demographics surrounding that location, I think, speak for themselves.
David Gager is an attorney whose client was taken to Homan Square in 2011 after being arrested for marijuana. 7,000 people were reportedly disappeared at the old Sears Roebuck and Company site, Chicago 60609 on Chicago's west side. David, thanks so much.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
A 72-year-old man, George Bell, was found dead in his New York City apartment days before anybody noticed. He had no living family. He bequeathed his roughly $500,000 in assets to people he hadn't spoken to in years. Perhaps least surprising for New Yorkers was that Bell's 10-year-old Toyota RAV4 had just over 3,000 miles on it. Here were some of the comments in the New York Times after his profile. I found this story exploitive and sensationalist, Rebecca commented. It is my biggest fear to die like this, John wrote. Dying alone reminds me of those chilling last phone calls from the summit of Mount Everest in the disaster of 1996. These are among the last words of climber Bruce Harrod.
I'm on top of the world, mate, seven.
Being alone is a scary prospect, but it is also peaceful. And Pam wrote, in death, George Bell's life found purpose to bring us face to face with our fears of loneliness, or to celebrate our solitude. Eric Kleinenberg is a professor of sociology at New York University and author of Going Solo, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone. He says the ancient terror of solitude is softened by the many ways we can still be connected.
Well, I think it strikes at some terror that many people have, a terror of being on their own. Living alone used to be unheard of. In 1950, less than 10% of American households were one-person households. Today, it's nearly 30% of all households at the national level, and about half of all Americans are single or unmarried. So it's a very big group. It includes people who have decided to not settle for a person they don't really want to love and have gone into their 30s or 40s without coupling up. It includes legions of people who have been in relationships and divorced or separated, and it includes large numbers of older people who have become widows or widowers.
Is loneliness a pejorative?
I think it has become a pejorative. I mean, the feeling of loneliness is something that's quite common, even for very healthy people. That feeling of loneliness is your body's signal that you need to get out into the world and seek out connection, companionship. Loneliness as a state of being is a very hard and difficult thing. But I think the issue here is that we often project loneliness onto people who live alone, even when we don't know whether or not they really are lonely.
What do you make of the story of George Beall in the New York Times? Is he a case that is not something we should be surprised about?
Well, we shouldn't be surprised because it has been happening, this case of people who live alone and also die alone. It's been happening for some time now. I've done a lot of research on these offices of the public administrator that seek out cases where people have died and no one comes to claim the body or the estate, and they have to make sense of whether there's next of kin and what to do with the body. It is sad that it happens like this, but at the same time, we don't really know whether George was truly lonely or sad himself. We don't know whether he was living alone because he really wanted to or because he had no other options. And so we tend to project our own anxieties onto cases like this. I guess when we're trying to understand a life, we really need to know much, much more before we can make those kinds of judgments.
Suspending judgment for a moment, I mean, is it conceivable that George Beall was quite at peace sitting in his Barca lounger, in front of the television, feeling himself slip away?
I think it is. In fact, I can say from the reporting I did for Going Solo, this book about the fact that there's so many people living alone in the world today, I found many people who said that they preferred living alone to other options. Some who preferred living alone and did not have a great appetite for companionship. It's a small number in the population, but it's large enough to produce the need for offices that manage cases like this. I think the issue is that we don't really know what the people in that situation want unless we ask while they're alive. Once they're dead, it's very difficult to tell.
And that's the irony here, is that there's so much focus on the, oh my gosh, 3 or 4 or 5 days that body stayed in there and nobody came. But what's fascinating to me is the hour before he died. We have this romantic notion of, you're in a hospice or in an intensive care unit and you're surrounded by family and friends with all these tubes in you. And to me, that is an absolute nightmare. I mean, everything, the tubes, the family, the whole thing, it's just horrible. What can we conclude about those last hours of someone like George Beall?
I actually investigated a case of a woman who died alone in Los Angeles not long ago in very similar circumstances. And I spoke to two different neighbors. And one of them said that she seemed like she lived a very happy life and that she was content up until the end. That's just how she was. And the other neighbor said this was the saddest thing and he felt terrible about himself, about the whole situation. So I don't know what we can conclude except for that we should be cautious to not put ourselves and our own opinions and views into these situations, because people prefer to live in different kinds of ways. I think we should focus on how the person lived as well as on the nature of the death.
I mean, there's a sense of Zen there that he's just sort of quietly saying goodbye that comes into play. Maybe that's another projection.
I think it's entirely possible that he died the way that he wanted to and in a way that reflected the way he preferred to live. At the same time, I know of other cases where people die alone because they've been abandoned or because they've failed to make the connections that they need. For instance, we live in a time when there's real issues with mental illness that keep people from establishing the relationships they want, or problems in city agencies that can't provide the home services to older people that they would like to get. So there are both kinds of cases out there. For me, what's powerful is to note that we are living and also dying in different ways these days. We have never before had so many people living alone, aging alone, and dying alone. I still think we're just beginning to figure out what to make of all that.
I'm wondering if your family got a little nervous when you decided to publish this book, Going Solo, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone. Did it deliver a message to them? Hey, Eric, you want to talk about something?
She sometimes jokes it's my fantasy book. But look, you know, I'm married. I have two young children, and I spend a lot of time in the schoolyard with other parents, and they tell me, you know, we're at a stage of life where the idea of having more time to yourself, more solitude, is pretty enticing. It's a full court press all the time when you're in domestic family life. And so you know, I think people have different kinds of needs. And on the one hand, we spend so much of our lives hyper-connected. We have these digital devices we carry everywhere we go and are constantly in communication. But on the other hand, more and more of us are living alone, are working independently. And so we have needs for both of those things.
Eric Kleinenberg is a professor of sociology at New York University and author of Going Solo, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone. Eric, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And here's something to take with you today. The ultimate trial balloon. The Washington Post published an article saying that Joe Biden had decided to enter the presidential race. He has 24 hours left in his self-imposed deadline. The clock is ticking, Joe. He's not speaking, and the Post eventually yanked its story. The statement, "This file was inadvertently published," replaced it. That's all for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.